Sooner or later, you can bet your life that every Jew in this building is going to say the same thing. He's a little too Jewish for my taste.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Jewish comedian Joel Chasnoff. We'll also have visits from our Two Jewish expert on the international scene, Tom Price, and our maven on Israel, Guy Gelbert. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio@yahoo.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. The election for President of the United States took most of our attention last week, and rightly so, as the world's second largest democracy, after India, by the way. We went to the polls and chose to re-elect Barack Obama as president, and the whole world watched. If national elections have a theme of any kind, and I'm not sure they all do, then some are inspirational, and some are angry, and some of them are flat-out depressing. But this one seemed, well, technical, perhaps even technological in a way that I don't really recall elections ever being so before. We were told early and often that just a few states, perhaps even just one, Ohio, would ultimately determine the results of the race for the most important elective office in the world. While that wasn't entirely true in the end, watching the returns and the very clever analysts on TV the other night, I was amazed that the experts now have this entire four-year process down to the turnout and the specific returns in just a very few polling places in a few counties in this enormous, complex country. When the number of folks that go to vote in Cuyahoga County outside of Cleveland and Miami-Dade in Florida establishes the resulting government for the next 4 years, we know a couple of important things. First, we know that America is almost exactly divided, a quite even split between the two essentially moderate parties, Democrats and Republicans, that frame our whole political system. Yes, I know, most Americans, and especially most American radio hosts, are convinced there's some sort of cataclysmic good versus evil split between the right and left in America. Those on the right are sure that Democrats are socialists and devoid of personal or family morality, and those on the left are sure that Republicans are fascists, dedicated to destroying our environment and giving all our money to the rich. None of that, of course, is completely true, or maybe even partially true. Having lived in a couple of other countries, I can tell you that what qualifies as left and right in America, generally speaking, is pretty much slightly one side and slightly the other side of the center, as the rest of the world calculates politics. We are at heart a moderate country that never really strays terribly far in either direction. That's what works for us most of the time, and that's what will continue to work for us for many, many years to come, God willing. We now have this down almost to a science. We seem never to elect one party to full control over the national government anymore, and that means that getting anything done will always come down to compromise and concession and carefully crafted agreements. You know, politics. Second, we know that it's possible to spend literally billions of dollars on a campaign and end up more or less where we started. I just can't stop thinking about what that kind of money, the money that was spent on TV ads and billboards and signs and poll workers and automated phone calls and Lord only knows what else, and wonder if that might have been of some help to the victims of, say, Hurricane Sandy, or to all those unemployed folks in our nation, or if it might actually have been enough money to solve hunger in America. Jewish priorities are rather different for spending, I think. Our first priority in my religion is to relieve the oppressed, not slander your political opponent. Why can't there be super PACs for poverty relief in America? That would be a new direction now, wouldn't it? Third, while there was a great deal of concern and even outright fear expressed that the results of this election would somehow spell doom for Israel, especially if President Obama were reelected, we here at Too Jewish never bought that for a minute. And those Jewish leaders who advocated so strongly for a different result, both from America and controversially even from Israel, did a profound disservice to the crucial relationship between Israel and America and the American government. The good part about politics is that most politicians have very short memories and very thick skins. I think it's unlikely that there will be truly long-standing negative consequences of those choices. But I suspect that Prime Minister Netanyahu, in particular, who came perilously close to endorsing his old friend Mitt Romney for president, will have some fence mending to do with the newly re-elected president of the United States for the next 4 years. And maybe some patching up to do with his own electorate in Israel before those elections take place in 2013. And finally, the continuing development of technological means to predict elections will eventually mean that we stop voting by the antiquated and patchwork and very messy ways we use in this great country of ours, and that we finally enter the 21st century in how we actually vote. At least I hope so. Because it's ridiculous. The nation of iPhone 5s and near-national Wi-Fi connectivity and super-focused political consultants who can tell you within a few hundred people how everybody in some area is going to vote. We still use felt pens and mail-in ballots and long lines and weird voting machines from the 70s and all the rest of this bizarre, archaic, inefficient machinery of elections in America in 2012. Well, now that I got that off my chest, it's time to move from voting to more important and, frankly, more enjoyable matters, like the upcoming holiday of Hanukkah, one of three great Thanksgiving-oriented festivals this fall, Sukkot, Thanksgiving, and Hanukkah, only one of which obligates us to eat turkey. And so, to play us in on this beautiful post-election fall Sunday morning, which is exactly a month from the first day of Hanukkah, believe it or not, here's the beginning of our pre-Hanukkah musical preview. Just 28 more shopping days until the first night of Hanukkah on Saturday, December 8th, not counting four Shabbat days, by the way, when we Jews really should not be shopping at all. In any case, here's the near-classic Adam Sandler shtick tune, The Hanukkah Song, Part 1, to start us on Hanukkah in advance in a very silly way.
Put on your yarmulke, here comes Hanukkah. So much Hanukkah to celebrate Hanukkah. Hanukkah is the festival of lights. Instead of one day of presents, we have eight crazy nights. When you feel like the only kid in town without a Christmas tree, here's a list of people who are Jewish. Just like you and me. David Lee Roth lights the menorah. So do James Conkirk Douglas and the late Dinah Shore. Guess who eats together at the Carnegie Deli? Bowser from Shanana and Arthur Fonzarelli. Paul Newman's half Jewish, Goldie Hawn's half too. Put them together, what a fine looking Jew. You don't need Deck the Halls or Jingle Bell Rock, 'cause you can spin a dreidel with Captain Kirk and Mr. Spock. Both Jewish. Put on your yarmulke, it's time for Hanukkah. The owner of the Seattle Supersonicas celebrates Hanukkah. O.J. Simpson, not a Jew. But guess who is? Hall of Famer Rod Carew. He converted. We got Ann Landers and her sister, dear Abby. Harrison Ford's a quarter Jewish, not too shabby. Some people think that Ebenezer Scrooge is. Well, he's not, but guess who is? All three Stooges. So many Jews are in showbiz. Tom Cruise isn't, but I heard his agent is. Tell your friend Veronica, it's time to celebrate Hanukkah. Oh, boy, get a harmonica on this lovely, lovely Hanukkah. So drink your gin and tonica. Have a happy, 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 happy Hanukkah. Happy Hanukkah.
That was Adam Sandler's first Hanukkah song. He's got three of them so far. Oddly, although he wrote and recorded it in 1994, it has been in the news again lately. You see, in the Hanukkah song, Sandler claims that Baseball Hall of Famer Rod Carew is Jewish. But Carew recently admitted that while his wife and kids are Jewish, and he took a class or two and celebrates Jewish holidays with his family, and even wears a Jewish star sometimes, he has never actually converted to Judaism. On the other side of the chocolate coin, however, Harrison Ford is listed by Sandler as being one-quarter Jewish, but actually Harrison Ford's mother is Jewish, and halachically speaking, he is actually, well, fully Jewish. Someone else who is fully Jewish is our guest this morning, the delightful Jewish comedian Joel Chazanoff, who will tell us what it's like to come from a Jewish day school background and flourish in the world of American comedy when we return on Too Jewish.
Hi, Joe Spina, Mama's Pizza. You know, it's common knowledge that what's large to one person may appear small to another. Take pizza, for example. Some places sell a, quote, large pizza for a pretty large price. Then surprise, you get it home, it barely feeds three people. Some places sell you two large pizzas for the price of one. Believe me, they can't be too large unless they're using real cheap ingredients. But that's a subject for another commercial. Anyway, at Mama's, we think our family-sized pizza should be the yardstick for measuring all pizzas. In fact, you need a yardstick to measure it. The bottom line is that pizza size is all relative. And on behalf of all my relatives, we invite you to Mama's to try one of our pizzas, no matter what size. After all, every Mama's pizza has a taste that's huge. Mama's Pizza with four convenient locations. You can check them all out at mamasfamous.com. Now repeat after me. Mama's Pizza!
Parents in Tucson have many choices on where to send their children to school. Consider the best. Consider Tucson Hebrew Academy. Now is the time to secure your spot for the upcoming school year. With a beautiful Foothills K-8 campus and award-winning academics, you owe it to your children to visit THA, Tucson Hebrew Academy, and see what they have to offer. Your child belongs at THA. THA delivers. Low student-teacher ratio supports successful, rigorous academics, and they don't stop there. With an emphasis on the arts, science, and music, THA students learn the Hebrew language and are taught Jewish values along with a rigorous academic curriculum. Your child deserves the best. Call 529-3888 to schedule your tour of THA. Financial aid is available. Don't wait. Space is limited. That's 529-3888 or visit www.thaaz.org. We are delighted to welcome to Too Jewish our guest this morning, comedian Joel Chazanoff. Joel is a stand-up comedian and author with stage and screen credits in eight countries, seven of them United States, actually. No, that's not true. February of 2010, he published his comedic memoir, The 188th Crybaby Brigade, about his years as a combat soldier in the Israeli army. He's gone to day school. He keeps kosher. He's not your typical American Jewish comedian. Welcome, Joel. Good morning.
Thanks. I'm happy to be here.
So, you talked a little bit in a show I saw you do about the nature of the different elements in Judaism. You welcomed the Chabad rabbis there.
Yes.
And then you were surprised their wives weren't there because...
Well, I said, I think we have some Chabad rabbis in the house, and everyone applauded, and I asked if their wives were there, and they were, and I said, I assumed you wouldn't be. I thought you'd be home giving birth. And people laughed, and I think it's universally recognized that they have, you know, 17, 20 kids each, and Sunday is the night they usually have a child.
That's so. Right. It's just by the way it works. What's your favorite kind of audience? Is it Orthodox, conservative, Reform, a mix, secular, birthright? Who do you like talking to the most?
really, my favorite audience is an audience that wants to be there. So I do colleges, too. I do a lot of Catholic schools because I'm clean, and Catholic schools want a clean comedian. And as long as the audience wants to be there and they haven't been forced to listen to you, that's a good crowd. Within the Jewish world, I like people who know about Judaism. Certainly, you know, we met at a day school show, and you and I mean. And I like that audience.
People are talking about that. I just want you to like.
Yeah. But that audience is good because if they're sending their kids to day school, it means they're engaged and they can understand the nuances of what I'm talking about. So I like an audience that has a Jewish knowledge, not just, you know, just being Jewish, I don't think is enough. I want them to have some sort of knowledge there so they can understand what I'm talking about.
You know, you shared in the show that you keep kosher, and then you tried to explain what it's like to explain keeping kosher to non-Jews.
Right.
I can relate to that. I used to fly through Salt Lake City on the way to a student pulpit in Billings, Montana.
Oh, wow.
Oh, my goodness. Every time I went through, someone would say, what do you do? And I'd say, I'm a rabbinic student. And they'd say, oh, I always wanted to learn about the Old Testament. Right. You know, they were Mormons. They were so sincere. Do you end up in those kinds of conversations very often?
I think I used to more. I think lately I just either diffuse it, and even if the Jewish part doesn't come up, even saying you're a comedian, it opens up a whole bag of worms. Is that even an expression? But, you know, then it's, oh, you don't seem funny, or, oh, where do you perform, or make me laugh. So I'll say, oh, I'm a teacher. That usually is pretty simple and boring. I've wanted to say stuff like, yeah, I'm a physician, or I'm an OBG. That just sounds so cool to have that knowledge. But I'm afraid someone would need to give birth on the plane, and then I would have
maybe
to
one
be
of the Chabad wives,
yeah, deliver, right, one of the Chabad rabbis on the plane. I'd have to deliver it, and that wouldn't be good.
We will talk much more with comedian Joel Chestnut when we come back this morning on Too Jewish.
When you're looking to buy or sell your home, you probably want Tucson's best realtor on your side. That realtor is Jill Rich. As real estate values change, it's comforting to know that Jill Rich knows Tucson's real estate landscape. She follows the trends. She knows the neighborhoods. She even knows how to help you find financing. But most importantly, Jill cares. It doesn't matter if you're looking for a starter home or a castle. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. For sellers, Jill will develop a personal marketing program that'll sell your house fast. There's no one who knows Tucson real estate better. You can reach Jill Rich at Long Realty's River and Campbell office. Call 349-0174. Jill Rich, providing strong representation in a caring way. Call 349-0174.
Attention, Arizona income taxpayers. You can help send children to our community's Jewish schools without it costing you a dime by directing your tax dollars to JETCO, the Jewish Education Tax Credit Organization. Here's how. State of Arizona allows taxpayers to get a dollar-for-dollar tax credit for payments made to recognized school tuition organizations who provide scholarships for kids in kindergarten through 12th grade to go to qualified private schools. JETCO provides a quality Jewish education to children in need at Congregation Anshe Israel Kindergarten, the Tucson Jewish Community Center Kindergarten, Temple Emmanuel's Kindergarten, and the Tucson Hebrew Academy. If you pay Arizona state income tax and make your contribution to JETCO, you'll get 100% tax credit on your Arizona state income tax return. Join over 750 supporters last year who gave money to JETCO and got it all back in the form of reduced or refunded state income tax. New this year, there's an additional tax credit, the switcher credit. It increases the maximum donation you can make to JETCO to $1,003 for single filers and $2,006 for married couples filing jointly. When we fight every day for the continuity of the Jewish people, take advantage of this great opportunity. JETCO is one way to foster a Jewish identity for our community's kids. Contributions to JETCO have helped hundreds of children receive financial aid in order to get a Jewish education. Call 647-8442, again, 647-8442, or visit JETCO on the web at www.jetco.org. Give the gift of education. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at TooJewishRadio@yahoo.com. That's T-O-O Jewish Radio at Yahoo. Or visit our website at TooJewishRadio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through our website by streaming them, or download us from the Apple iTunes Store as very popular Too Jewish podcasts.
And now, in a mild twist, here is our 2012 presidential election campaign post-mortem Jewish moment. President Barack Obama won 69% of the Jewish vote, according to most exit polls. Those polls were in line with projections in the pre-election period by Gallup, the American Jewish Committee, and others, who said that Obama would win between 65 and 70% of the Jewish vote, as we also predicted here on Too Jewish. Both parties blitzed Jewish voters in swing states, particularly Ohio and Florida, ahead of the election. You may remember the billboard, "It's a mitzvah to vote for Romney," and "Bubbies for Barack." Anyway, Jews constituted about 2% of the overall voters nationwide. Republicans noted a discrepancy between last Tuesday's election numbers and the 78% Obama got in the 2008 presidential election. Democratic spinners, citing a more recent, broader study of the 2008 results, say that Obama actually got 74% of that year's Jewish vote, and therefore 69% is kind of within the margin of error. It looks to me here on Too Jewish as though Obama lost some Jewish voters this time around, but clearly not enough to throw the election to Romney in those key states like Florida and Ohio. Apparently, the Republican Party remains a tough sell to the majority of American Jews. And also apparently, Obama's political guru, David Axelrod, who is Jewish, is still pretty darn smart about American elections. In Jewish news farther down the ticket, generally speaking, Jewish Republicans lost, and Jewish Democrats, at least the incumbents, mostly won. Rabbi Shmuley Boteach, the author of Kosher Sex and Kosher Jesus, and twice a guest of us on Too Jewish, nonetheless lost his race for Congress in New Jersey, as did fellow Republican Randy Altshuler in New York. Jewish former Marine Josh Mandel lost his Senate bid in Ohio, as did Jewish former Governor of Hawaii Linda Lingle. Past Too Jewish guest Eric Cantor, the Republican whip in Congress, was easily reelected, proving there is no Too Jewish political jinx. The fight between Jewish California Democratic congressional incumbents Brad Sherman and Howard Berman, they rhyme but don't get along, shoved into the same district by redistricting, came to a close without further fisticuffs. The two actually had a physical altercation on camera when the younger Sherman grabbed Berman at a college debate during the campaign. But Sherman won re-election nonetheless in the San Fernando Valley. And that was our campaign 2012 Jewish post-mortem election moment. Zecher tzadik livracha. May these elections rest in peace and righteousness. We welcome our maven on Israel, Guy Gelbart, head of the Weintraub Israel Center here in Tucson. Boker Tov, Guy. Good morning.
Boker Tov, Rabbi.
Now, you drove here in a gasoline-powered car, like almost all Americans. They have some hybrids. There's a few electric cars. But in Israel, something we've been talking about for a while, this next best place, is it called?
Better place.
Better place. Thank you. You can now not only drive in an electric car, but drive into a changing station, swap your battery, and get a new battery and drive further. This is an exciting beginning, started by a guy named Shai Agassi, who's no longer part of Better Place. Maybe you can give us kind of an overall perspective on this new Israeli deal.
Yeah, Better Place was created by Shai Agassi, as you said. Shai Agassi came from the high-tech industry. He basically started as a software guy, studied at a Technion, and became the leader of SAP, huge software company.
Right.
And then he left SAP, surprisingly, to the high-tech industry was shocked by him leaving SAP.
He was the CEO, I think, at the time.
He was, I don't remember if it was the CEO or the
pretty
second man up or something of that sort. But yes, he was very high up, and he left it and started a new startup, basically, called Better Place. And his concept was, let's make electric cars. But instead of trying to figure out how to make batteries last longer, let's find a way to swap the batteries really quick. So basically, you would have the car, you would owe the car, but the battery within the car would be a rental. You would come to the swapping station, and for the same price that you would pay for a full tank of gas, you will swap your battery in 30 seconds or 60 seconds or something of that sort, which is quite about the average time that it would take you to fill gas in a normal gas station. That's his concept. And he came up with the idea that Israel would be the best beta place, beta site to test this concept. I'm not sure if the audience are familiar with the phrase beta site.
Well, we talk about beta testing with software. People are probably familiar. But this was going to be the place to test it because it's a small country with a lot of drivers who don't go very far, but, you know, need to be able to get around.
Right. Israel, you know, just for the correction of information for our audience, the size of Israel, if you're driving from north to south, from Metula to Elat, is probably about 285 miles.
Right.
If you're going from Tel Aviv all the way across to the Jordan River, you would be driving 33 miles. If you're going to the security fence, you would be driving 11 miles.
Right.
So the size is very small, which allows to build a grid of stations that will enable you to swap the battery very quickly. They got a lot of people invested in this company.
Like $400 million, you were saying, I think?
$400 million as the first investment into this program. And now it's actually starting to work. We see cars driving. It's still early to say if this will become the big next thing and if Israelis will buy into it. There are a lot of pros and cons into getting that specific car. For one, currently they have an agreement only with one car manufacturer.
Yeah, Renault or somebody. Right.
Right. Which kind of limits your options as a customer. Also, I think some people might be a little afraid of being committed only to using those batteries and so on. On the other hand, talking to some friends of mine that are driving those cars, they say, you know, guy, you don't hear the engine. You drive a car and it's completely silent and it's smooth and it's nice and it's clean. It's
yep.
a clean energy.
And of course, you can plug in when you get home too to charge your car. You don't only have True. To swap the battery. But it's pretty exciting. I mean, this is cutting edge. It's in Israel. It ain't in the United States yet. We'll see if it comes here too. Thanks, guy. We'll talk next week.
Thank you.
When we come back, we'll hear from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, and get the old Jewish joke of the week.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
You recently came back from a trip to Europe, and you started to talk off mic about the Bosnian Jewish community, which I know nothing about. Why don't you catch us up?
Right. So last week, we talked briefly about my visit to Dubrovnik, and then a friend who was a Bosnian Muslim refugee who went to high school, college, and a decade after college in Vienna, drove down from Sarajevo to take me and two friends from Green Valley by car up from Dubrovnik to Sarajevo with several stops. The border is about 10 minutes outside of Dubrovnik. It's quite amazing. You come to this little house on the road, and it's the Croatian border. It's very fast and efficient. And then you get to the Bosnian entry point, and it's a lot slower and less efficient. And one of the things you quickly realize is that Bosnia was, at least in part of its territory, part of the mysterious East, part of the Ottoman Empire, whereas Croatia was, in its entirety, part of Austro-Hungary. And it's very Western. It uses the Latin alphabet. Bosnian officially does too, but it's really bilingual between Serbian and Croatian. So there are a lot of signs in Cyrillic. And because of the Dayton Peace Accords, weirdly, you keep crossing the border between the so-called Serbian Republic of Bosnia and the Federation of Croats and Muslims that was artificially created at Dayton. So the signs change constantly. When you're in Trebinje, which used to be a very mixed city with mosques and synagogues and churches, Now it's all Serbs, and all the signs are in Cyrillic, and everybody else feels uncomfortable. It's a beautiful little city, and my Bosnian friend was actually born there. We then drove up to Mostar, where the famous Ottoman bridge over the Neretva River is, and it's been restored by the Turks. It was destroyed in the war. And basically, on one side of the river was the Muslim quarter, and the other side was the Croatian, i.e. Roman Catholic, quarter of town. And they killed each other, and the town was a scene of terrible desolation. I remember visiting it right after the war. Well, now it's been totally restored by the Turks, who in exchange got a wonderful location in the center of town for a major consulate general. But what I learned that I never knew before, because I had a local guide who was very sensitive to my own ethnicity, is that Mostar had a huge Jewish community, still has a small one, and a Jewish cemetery. So we didn't have time to visit the cemetery, but I did see pictures and postcards. It's quite an impressive place. Okay, so then we get to the capital of Bosnia-Herzegovina, which is Sarajevo. And Sarajevo is the place where the famous Sarajevo Haggadah was published, where lots of Israeli generals and political bigwigs hail from, where Rabbi Alkali, one of the earliest Zionists in the 19th century, comes from. And it's a very old Sephardic Jewish community, and more recently also an Ashkenazic Jewish community. And it's fascinating not only because of the various types of Jews who lived together and still do, by the way, but also because of all the other ethnicities who coexisted there in what was a model of Ottoman tolerance and cosmopolitanism. And I see we're running out of time, so I'll go into more detail about Sarajevo specifically next week.
Fascinating, Tom. Great start. Looking forward to it. Talk to you next week.
Thank you.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a Public Service. Moshe is driving his car in Jerusalem. He's late for a crucial business meeting. He's very stressed. He's looking for a parking place, and he just can't find one. In desperation, he turns towards heaven and says, "Lord, if you find me a parking place, I promise I'll only eat kosher food. I'll observe the laws of Shabbos. I'll give 10% of everything I earn to tzedakah, to charity." Miraculously, a parking place opens up just in front of him. Moshe turns his face to heaven and says, "Never mind. I just found one." That was the old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew. A special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. And special thanks to my friend and colleague Charles Heller for several ancient but delightful jokes. And now a word of Torah. The story of the twins, Jacob and Esau, begins in utero. Rivals from before birth, wrestling in their mother Rebecca's womb, the red-haired outdoorsman Esau and his grasping, domestically inclined younger brother Jacob spend our portion of Toldot vying for their father's and mother's love and attention. Each is partly successful and each partly fails. That sibling rivalry shaped the course of our people's early history, but it can also teach us something about ourselves. First, a word about words. Toldot is rich in real-life details told in spectacularly perfect writing. Rebecca, pregnant with the two boys wrestling around inside her, tells God, "If it's like this, why am I alive?" Prefiguring the words of every pregnant mom at some point. Esau is hairy and rough at birth. Jacob is smooth, born holding fast to Esau's heel. Esau, famished from a long hunt, trades his birthright for a bowl of porridge, and then ate, drank, stood up, left, and disdained. The series of active verbs delineating his turbulent, thoughtless character. Jacob, smooth-faced, smooth-talking lawyer that he is, audibly calculates the coming consequences of each and every action. Now, on to that little rivalry. The familial tension in Toldot is palpable throughout. In fact, there's tzoras enough to go around for everybody in this small family. Isaac, the father and link between more important patriarchs, finds trouble everywhere but avoids it by simply moving on. Each time he finds more success and then more trouble and moves again. Rebecca sees the wayward ways of her eldest boy Esau and chooses to manipulate the situation to give the inheritance to Jacob, remaking the birth order retroactively. But the great struggle is between Jacob and Esau. I'm reminded of the 1960s TV stars The Smothers Brothers' old line, "Mom liked you best." Mom certainly liked Jacob best, but Dad liked Esau best. That kind of favoritism cannot end well, and in the short term, it doesn't. At the end of our portion, Esau has been doubly defrauded while Jacob is forced to flee the consequences of his own duplicity, running from the only home he has known without so much as a blanket. In a sense, this conflicted family damages all of its members. Each is wounded in one way or another, none left really whole. It's a drama worthy of, well, worthy of so many of our own lives. And yet, in a couple of more Torah portions, we will see that each member of this now shattered nuclear family has played or will play a central role in furthering God's design for our world. In spite of their mistakes and their injuries, each helps, ultimately, to carry out pivotal elements that further God's mission and that will create the great people of Israel. In challenging times and in conflicted families, it's often hard to see that ultimately there is a divine plan, a place for each participant. But Toldot, which means generations, by the way, teaches us that in spite of what we might perceive in our own small field of vision, God is at work in this world, and we may very well be furthering a greater plan. When we come back on Too Jewish, our delightful guest Joel Chasnoff will tell us why Jews are so darned funny. As my kids constantly tell me, present company meaning me accepted. Find out when we come back on Too Jewish in a moment.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reformed, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470. We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
So apparently, Elie Wiesel and President Barack Obama are writing a book together, the Holocaust survivor and author said last week. The book, which the two men will resume writing after the last presidential election, you know, the one last week, is a book of two friends. Wiesel, a Nobel laureate and past guest of Too Jewish, says, Wiesel and Obama became friends back in 2009 when he joined Obama on a visit to the site of the Buchenwald concentration camp, where Wiesel was interned at the end of World War II following a death march from Auschwitz. We talked about philosophy, contemplation, thought, but never about politics. Obama is a thinking person, a person with depth and intellectual curiosity, Wiesel said, about the dinners the two occasionally have together. Wiesel and Obama first met when Wiesel lectured at California's Occidental College, where Obama was an undergrad. Your lecture has stayed with me to this day, the president told Wiesel years later. When I heard that, my pulse went up. I told myself that I have to be careful, because I can never know whether anyone in the audience will be a future president, Wiesel continued. In other, I guess, literary news, Israeli author A.B. Yehoshua was awarded a prestigious French literary award. Yehoshua received the Prix Medici Etranger, a French literary award for a translated work for his novel The Retrospective. The book, originally published in Hebrew in 2011, has been translated into several languages, including French, and will be published in English next year. It tells the story of an old filmmaker who visits Spain for a retrospective of his work and reconnects with a scriptwriter from his past. The encounter sends him on a journey of reconciliation and reparation. A.B. Yehoshua has won the Israel Prize for Hebrew Literature and many other literary awards. He's popular in France, where he lived for 3 years back in the 1960s. In Israel itself, in what truly constitutes shocking news, the staff of the Israeli daily newspaper Ma'ariv has gone on strike. Now, I know a strike in Israel is never a surprise, but what makes this shocking is that in the past 64 years, Ma'ariv has never before gone on strike. That makes it just about the only Israeli entity except the armed forces never to have been on strike. No newspaper was printed last Wednesday. The newspaper's website was not updated after Tuesday evening when the employees walked out. The strike comes following the sale of the newspaper to Shlomo Ben Zvi. The strikers say they took the action after Ben Zvi violated the collective bargaining agreement and the collective agreement itself that he signed with them. Ben Zvi announced that a percentage of the current employees would be absorbed into the new ownership's operation, but at a lower salary to be determined in new negotiations. Ma'ariv's employees want to know how many of them will be hired and what the newspaper structure will be, the workers said. Ben Zvi called the strike a breach of the collective agreement. This is the first strike at the newspaper in 64 years, during which time Israel has had about, 100,000 strikes, conservatively speaking. The lead story on the Ma'ariv website dealt with the employee strike. There was no mention of the U.S. presidential election. And finally, Israel's government approved the immigration of the B'nai Menashe, an Indian tribe that claims Jewish ancestry. This approval comes after a 5-year gap since the last group of B'nai Menashe arrived in Israel. Members of the group who claim descent from the lost tribe of Menashe must undergo a conversion process, even though it is accepted as fact that they do have Jewish roots. The Israeli cabinet voted 2 weeks ago to restart the tribe's aliyah, immigration from India to Israel, and a flight of more than 270 B'nai Menashe will reportedly arrive this coming week. The new immigration will be funded and facilitated by Shavei Yisrael, a non-governmental organization that helps locate and reconnect to Judaism and Israel the descendants of Jews. Some 1,700 B'nai Menashe from India are living in Israel. As many as 9,000 remain behind in India and Burma. And that's the two Jewish news of Jews around the world. We are delighted to welcome back to Two Jewish our guest this morning, comedian Joel Chasnoff. He is clean and Jewish and, most importantly, really funny. Good morning, Joel. Welcome back.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
So you speak about a lot of different themes. You wrote a book about your experience in the Israeli army. What possessed you to do this?
Well, there are two sides to that decision. When I was a kid, I went to Jewish day school myself, grew up really loving Israel. I loved the stories of the Six-Day War, the raid on Entebbe. I love the idea that there were Jews who weren't scared to stand up for themselves. And that part of me felt it wasn't fair. I remember the Gulf War when I was in high school, first Gulf War, watching bombs fall on Ramat Gan and thinking it wasn't fair that Israelis were fighting and we were sending checks and praying, but not really putting our lives on the line. So part of it is what I wanted to do, my fair part for Israel. But the other part is I wanted to be one of those hero Jews, one of those badass Israelis I'd grown up admiring. And the one way to do that was to join the army itself. I remember going to Israel when I was 17 on a teen tour and seeing the Israeli soldiers who were a year older than I was. And they had Uzis and sunglasses and berets. And then there was me, a year younger than them, wearing slathered in sunscreen, wearing a fanny pack, totally uncool, and I wanted to be them, and that was the other part of the decision.
So you made the decision.
I made the decision when I was 18. My parents wouldn't let me go, so I finally went after college when I was, in the end, I was 24 years old in a platoon of 18-year-old Israelis, and that's this book I wrote. A lot of that, the humor in the book is based on that complete, you know, fish out of water experience, being an Ivy League grad with a bunch of kids who graduated high school 2 weeks before their army service began.
And had really never done anything except be in school in Israel.
Exactly. Some of them, they'd never slept away from home before.
And here they were in Lebanon.
And here, well, we had basic training first, but eventually, right. Yeah, 7 months later, we were in Lebanon.
So you went to Penn, graduated, mm-hmm. And after all, I mean, Penn is in a neighborhood that's a little bit like Lebanon.
But. Yeah, but Pan is more dangerous than Lebanon. So Lebanon was nothing after West Philly. But I did have a tank in Lebanon, so it all evened out.
Yeah, it worked out a little bit better. What was your favorite story? I mean, you have a great story about you get to the Israeli army, you know, they issue you all the wrong size clothing, and they issue your dog tags.
Right, my dog tags, which I got at the induction center. And this is a big moment that you're officially a soldier when you get your dog tag. It had my personal number, which I'll never forget, 5481287. My first name, Yoel, which is Hebrew for Joel. But my last name was a mistake. Instead of Chasnov, it said Shitznitz. And this is, you know, a very important item.
Sorry, I didn't mean to laugh.
No, it's absurd. And I said to the guy, this 18-year-old punk who... you know, was making the dog tags. I said, you misspelled my name. And in typical Israeli fashion, his response was, so don't die, which is just so Israeli. And I found that the army was full of this stuff. The myth of the Israeli army is that mighty army like Entebbe in the Six-Day War, which can never be defeated. But the reality is, it's an army run by Israelis who are the most argumentative, outspoken people out there. And so they're always cutting corners. They're always looking for a way to save time and, you know, save their own workload. And so that was the hardest part. It wasn't the physical exercise, the punishments. It was being 24 and mature in this army run by kids.
Okay, well, let's shift gears a little bit. What's the most ridiculous Jewish holiday?
I still don't know what Shmini Atzeret is. ridiculous Lag BaOmer. That's sort of a little-known holiday, but we celebrate Lag BaOmer by shaving. I just find it fascinating that we have a holiday that you celebrate by doing normal daily hygiene because no other... You know, you won't find that anywhere else. You'll never clip your toenails for Jesus, but we believe in celebrating by shaving. We've got a lot of weird holidays.
So when you were trying to explain kashrut to somebody not Jewish, mm-hmm. what possessed you to answer them when they asked why you didn't eat meat and cheese together?
Well, my instinct is always, and ever since I was a kid in restaurants with my parents, we grew up conservative, so we would eat in non-kosher restaurants, but we would eat omelets and tuna, et cetera, and we would always say, oh, we're vegetarian. And I still do that now with my own kids. I say, just say you're vegetarian because I don't feel like explaining we don't eat milk with meat because then they'll ask, well, we have a hamburger. And I have to explain, well, the burger has to be killed in a nice way. And there's all these more, you know, more layers of rules. But when I do explain it, usually it's because I think, you know what, this will be my chance to share the joys of Judaism. And it never turns out the right way. I just find myself digging myself into a deeper and deeper hole. Because unless you are Jewish, it really is impossible to understand how neurotic we get about our rules and what will follow.
You know, I have trouble explaining it to my wife, let alone my congregation.
Right.
You know, without that neuroses, would there be so much Jewish comedy?
There would absolutely not. I think being neurotic is part of what makes us who we are, whether it's Woody Allen or Seinfeld had, you know, his observations. You have to be a little neurotic to pay that close attention to everything going around you. And certainly Larry David has that going for him or against him as well. And what is a comedian? It's someone who's on the side observing, looking at what's wrong with this picture and then commenting on it. And if you're a relaxed human being, comfortable in your life, you're not going to be looking at the world around you at all the things that are wrong and out of place. You have to be neurotic in order to get that humor out of it.
Death is easy. Comedy is hard.
Yeah, someone once said dying is easy. Comedy is tough.
What's more terrifying, getting up on a stage when you're really not sure what you're about to get or, day school finals?
Well, in the early days, I used to feel ill before every stand-up show because so much was on the line. Now I know how to deal with it. Now I know how to deal with a 300-seat auditorium where there are only 20 people. You find ways to make it work. Each show is different. Comedy doesn't terrify me the way it used to, but there's still that little element of, you know, unknown, of not knowing where it's going to end up. And no two shows are ever alike.
Because the audience is different?
The audience is different. If it's going well, I'll begin to improvise and let a joke that comes into my head go further and further. And if that does work, it's great. And if it doesn't work, there's that moment of, you know, like when you're standing on the edge of the swimming pool and you're about to plunge in, but you find your balance again. So it's I'm constantly driving, you know, navigating through the road at, during a stand-up show. It's never scripted.
Is when you're addressing a non-Jewish audience, because you said you do Catholic schools.
Sure. And,
your material that I've heard is really Jewish.
Yes.
How do you make it referable?
Well, it's different material.
I mean, isn't it too Jewish?
Some of it is. When I talk about the Amida, which is the prayer we say in the morning services, a lot of Jews don't get that, let alone non-Jews. When I do a show for a Catholic school, I'll talk maybe a few minutes about Jewish mothers and Jewish guilt, which they can relate to because they have their own Catholic guilt. But the rest of it, I'll talk about American politics or college life or beer.
Everybody can relate.
Yeah,
to
you, there are certain things that bind us all.
What's the? Have you ever told a joke at a Jewish audience and realized you just shouldn't have told that?
Oh yes, I don't have an example. I wish I could think of a good example, but there have definitely been times when. Yeah, I think the worst example is.
I just want to take you through your worst moments here today.
I know there was a time when I told a joke about some sort of... I talk about genetic diseases, Crohn's, colitis, Tay-Sachs, and how we could never have a Jewish superhero because too many things bother our bodies. You know, Superman had kryptonite, but we have peanuts and milk. That would destroy us. And then after the show, someone said, you know, the honoree, you know, her... Some relative had passed away from an extreme case of Crohn's. You shouldn't have said that. Now, how would I know? And now before shows, I'll say, you know, is there anyone, any tragedies I should know about that I shouldn't mention a certain disease or event happening? And, you know, you can never know for sure. But I like the danger of that, too.
What's the most fun you've had as a comedian?
Wow. I mean, being up on stage is just when a show is going well and you're connecting with the audience. I'd say the highlight is when someone begin a dialogue for whatever reason with someone in the crowd, not necessarily a heckler, but just someone who is begging to be picked on, and it works and it clicks. And that in the moment creation of new jokes, it's just a thrilling experience.
I want to thank Joel Chestnut for a great visit.
Is that really all our time?
That's all our time. Wow. You'll have to come back. We'll get you on the phone.
It was
get
a
you
lot
back
of fun.
Here.
It was a lot of fun.
Delighted. How can people find out more about your stuff?
Oh, that's so nice of you. Well, I have a website, joelchestnut.com, or you can Google Jewish comedian, and I'm in the middle of page 9027 or something there. But if you just Google Joel Chestnut comedian or Crybaby Brigade, my book will come up. It's called The 188th Crybaby Brigade, and everything you need is on that website.
Thanks, Joel. It's great. And
thank you, Sam.
A great representative of Jewish comedy.
No, thank you.
When we come back, we'll hear about next week's guest, get a final musical play out on Too Jewish.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday at 9 a.m. Our guest will be Harry Broad, the author of the brand new book, Superman is Jewish? How Comic Book Superheroes Came to Serve Truth, Justice, and the American Jewish Way. Our playout this morning is also from our pre-Hanukkah preview of music. Here's the classic Hanukkah O Hanukkah from the rock group The Bare Naked Ladies, whose lead singer is Jewish. My friends, may you have a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, an election-free week of peace.
Oh, Hanukkah, come light the menorah. Let's have a party, we'll all dance the whore. Gather around the table, we'll give you a treat. A simply fun to play with and latkes to eat. And while we are playing, the candles are burning low. One for each night they shed a sweet light to remind us of days long ago. One for each night they shed a sweet light to remind us of days long ago.
Hanukkah! candles are burning low. One for each night they share a sweet light to remind us of days long ago. One for each night they share a sweet light to remind us of days long ago. Days long ago. One for each night they share a sweet light to remind us of days long ago.